Welcome to Beach Books and Beyond with me, Monique Chambers. Each week, I invite a different guest from a different walk of life to talk to me about books that they've read, which have influenced them, and books they suggest we take to the beach this summer. You've no excuse not to be well read. Welcome to this week's edition of Beach Books and Beyond. This week I'm joined by Rachel Baldacchino. Now, you're a doctoral student?
Student, yes.
Student, it sounds so grand. What are you studying?
I am writing a doctoral dissertation in the field of literary studies.
Okay.
So I study the essays of an author called Vernon Lee, who was born in 1856 to British parents, but they lived in Florence. And she was part of the aesthetic movement, so her contemporaries were Oscar Wilde, Walter Pater, Simmons. And then during the First World War, when the First World War broke out, she became a pacifist activist, and her writings took quite a political turn. And so I'm studying the nonfiction that she wrote during that period, which consists of pamphlets, it consists of drama as well. She wrote two plays about the war, the First World War, called The Ballet of the Nations and Satan the Waster. And she also wrote journalism, which I look at in my dissertation as well. So she was a bit of a hybrid writer. She was also a psychologist. She studied the psychology of empathy very closely. So she wrote about three or four collections of essays on the psychology of empathy. So I look at the intersection between these essays on empathy and her more political work. Yeah, so that's my job, and it has been for the past 3 years.
So you're coming to the end then?
I am coming to the end, yes. My doctoral defence is scheduled in Belgium, because that is where my university is, on the 16th of October.
Oh, good luck with that.
Yeah.
And how did you discover Vernon Lee and take such an interest, actually, to go to such a length?
Studying her work. Well, we, at the University of Leuven, there was a group of researchers who came together to discuss authors of the what we call the long 19th century. The scope of the research group was to dig a little bit deeper than the received canon to find perhaps forgotten voices.
Okay.
A colleague of, and a friend of mine at the time, Stephanie, she was looking at the supernatural short story in the 19th century, and Vernon Lee had written some ghost stories, and so we used to discuss her work, and she used to mention pretty frequently, but she wrote so much, and most of it is, well, went through a first edition but got lost along the way, and it would be interesting to dig into that. And then, well, I spoke to the Dean of Research and my tutor, who's head of women's studies, and they thought it was a project worth pursuing, and that became my project.
Your obsession, your life.
Well, yes, my work life for sure. I tried to, it became a bit of an obsession, but I try to kind of keep it within.
Do you feel like you sort of live alongside her sometimes when you're so ingrained in her life and her work? Do you sometimes feel like she's with you?
It's a little bit odd, yes. I did a year and a half ago, I bought a new pair of spectacles, and then I came across a portrait someone had, and I found that they were identical.
That's just giving me shivers.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, at that point I said, okay, is this bordering on the unhealthy? But it was pretty funny, actually. Yeah.
But she wants her story
actually,
told, it
sounds like. Actually, it was a portrait that John Singer Sargent drew of her. I think it's at the National Portrait Gallery in London. It's a very pretty portrait of her.
So you think she lives a bit with you, and she, her story needs to be told, and her works need to be exposed a bit more than they were at the time?
Yes, I think, yes, it's worth, you know, poring over history every now and then to see why stories get forgotten and whether they hold any value, whether they still speak to us today. And I do find that turn of the century writers who were just, you know, who were coming to terms with massive changes, mm-hmm. especially those brought about by the First World War, they faced a lot of challenges which we kind of face. They can speak to us, I find, still on various levels.
You wish we'd learn a bit more from the past. So are there works of hers that you think, for people who just wanted an introduction, are there works of hers that people should read and take a look at?
Well, yes. I always suggest works which I'm not studying, because the ones I am studying are quite heavy in nature, I guess. Well, for example, The Ballad of the Nations is an interesting book to look at. Mm-hmm. It was published as a Christmas book, so it has illustrations.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It was published in 1915 as a Christmas book, but I don't think that the illustrated edition, the first edition, is accessible, so it would have to be an antique shop where you would get your hands
on
it.
Dig around and find.
But she wrote a lot of what we might, you know, classify as travel pieces or travelogues, but she called them more essays on the spirits of places. So she travelled quite a lot in Europe,
mm-hmm.
and not just in. She spent her summers mostly in London, so in England, to forge contacts with publishers, because she published mostly in English, although she was a polyglot. But she didn't just travel within England, so she did go around various towns and villages in Europe quite a lot, apart from the big cities such as Paris and Rome and Venice and Florence. And she has, for example, an essay collection called The Enchanted Woods, or Genius Loci, Essays on the Spirits of Places. And I think they would be quite an interesting place to start from.
And they might
exploring her
might
her
give
work.
People they're, ideas of not just her life, but also how places were in those times.
Yes, and they're gentle vignettes. They're pretty short, 5-6 pages, so we have time to squeeze that into our
so daily busy lives.
Yes. Yeah.
It's one of those, we're sort of talking about beach books, maybe it's, you know, you tan for this side and then you can turn over and read another one.
Yes,
so it's perfect,
definitely.
Perfect
it
way
is.
To time your
and
tanning.
And also the horror stories, perhaps. Mm. Might. It's not what I mean, something I'm really into, but for people who like that, mm-hmm. that's another side of her which can be quite accessible. Because I presume she wrote those to sell as well. They sold pretty well at the time.
What sort of books do you read for fun when you're not studying? Is it other autobiographies and biographies and
yes.
lives of other people
yes,
of the same period, or do you...
Not of the same period. A little bit less of the same period. I tend to explore more contemporary grounds in my free time. I have been reading less because of the amount of reading mm-hmm. I do in terms of peer-reviewed articles and all that academic texts, etc. But there is always a book I'm exploring.
Do you read books about people that you like, or people you dislike, or people you don't know, or people that have been suggested to you?
I like to read memoirs a lot, yes, definitely. Mm. And then I would be reading memoirs of authors who I have enjoyed, who have accompanied me throughout my life.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Doris Lessing.
Okay.
But not just. Recently I read Steve Martin's, the stand-up
okay.
comedian's memoir. It's called Born Standing Up, A Comic's Life. It's a funny book, mm. but it's also a very intimate account of the struggles, the 10-year struggle he went through before he gained any sort of recognition. Mm. And that was a very endearing book. I also read Anthony Bourdain, the chef's...
Oh yeah, I don't like him, you see.
It's true that he is a little bit... He comes across... Why don't you like
him? Just a bit in your face and a bit sort
yes.
of... Yeah, I don't even like how he appears on TV.
He is exhausting. I've followed him a little bit, but then got over him pretty quickly. But his writing does give you another side to him. So, Adventures from the Culinary, I forget the name, but yeah, From the Culinary Underbelly, something like that.
That sounds a bit like him, yes.
Yeah, but he does have an eye for detail in his writing, and he taps into a lot of memories of his childhood and links them with favourite dishes that then accompanied him throughout his life in terms of what he cooks nowadays in his restaurants, etc.
Okay.
And it does give you a sort of window, also the rough kind of environment in kitchens growing up and as a teenager, having such an ambition, having to work with massive egos. I do like reading memoirs. I don't know, are you familiar with an author, an American author called Mary Carr?
No, tell us.
She teaches creative writing at Syracuse University, and she wrote a series of memoirs on her quite turbulent childhood. And a beautiful memoir that she wrote is called The Liar's Club. But she also wrote a book about writing memoirs called The Art of Memoir. And the last pages of that book are extremely generous in that she lists the memoirs that have inspired her
okay.
as a prominent memoir writer in the US. And there is a fountain of sources, and they range from Vladimir Nabokov's Speak Memory, for example, to Mary McCarthy's memoir. It's about growing up as a Catholic in the 60s in the US.
Quite a difficult time.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other books that you read? Are you any novels at all? Any plays? Anything like that?
I have read novels, and I am reading a novel at the moment by, is it Ferrante? I even forget. I don't have a close. I'm not very interested in
the who did
in novels. Actually, there are a lot of novels that have shaped me, and I think I will come to a time where I will sit with novels again. But I prefer to go to poetry and to comics. Relax.
That's really interesting.
Having lived in Belgium for 10 years, I discovered the magnificent world of comics that ranges from the Japanese manga to more elaborate graphic novels to graphic novels that are journalistic pieces. So I've done quite a lot of reading in that field. It is something I do less now because comics are less accessible in Malta. And I used to love just not having to order them online, just going out for a coffee, passing by a bookshop, peeping in and saying, oh, that looks interesting, going in, having a chat with the owner, and then
coming
leaving
out with
five or six new titles. And also the libraries there, they all had a very extensive comic section.
Because I know there is a comic scene here. I'm not sort of involved at all, so but there's a Malta Comic Con.
Yes, the com. I have
there's a few writers I notice on Facebook posting occasional works. So there is a scene, but obviously a much, much, much smaller scene than.
I think it is related, or it is strongly oriented towards perhaps the superhero comic book, which this is a little bit less what I'm talking about. So, for example, a book I strongly recommend is a book by the Japanese author called Shigeru Mizuki, who died 3 years ago at the age of 93. And Shigeru Mizuki, he's also a historian, but he grew up in a coastal town. He was born in Osaka, and he was a very rowdy boy. He had an exceptional talent for drawing, for pencil drawing. At the age of 10, he had mesmerized his teachers, and they had organized a collective exhibition of his work. But he just spent his childhood drawing and being part of boy gangs in the city, disturbing people, fighting each other, and also listening to the tales of an old woman in the village who was an expert on what the Japanese call the yokai, who are the spiritual ghosts of the towns and cities of Japan. Yeah. He wrote a book, an autobiography, of his childhood based on all the stories that she told him, and he called it Nononba, which was the nickname that he used for her. So that is one of my favorites. It's a thick book. He published it in Japan in the 70s, but it only came to Europe a few years ago. In France first in 2006, and then in 2010, I believe, it was translated into English.
Okay.
Shigeru Mizuki is a big name in Japan, but
No, I was just going to ask which languages you read in, because I'm sort of, having lived in Brussels, I'm assuming you speak French as well.
Yes, I had read this first in French in 2006, but then bought it in both languages. But I read in French, in German, which I have studied. I worked as a translator in Belgium, so in English, French, German. I like to read in Italian as well, English and Maltese,
That's enough to keep you going, I think. So there are other books as well that you could recommend to us that this one sounds fascinating. What's it called?
Nononba. So Nononba. It's Nonba. So it's one word. This is fascinating. Yeah, I mean, I could talk about manga, but I guess that's a good taste of that. But I also like to read poetry collections. Mm-hmm. I have poetry very much after my heart, because when there is literally no time, but you are looking for depth or for intensity, I don't like to read at the beach because the sun just disturbs my focus. So I don't read light books either at the beach. I swim and slip away. But even if you're at the beach and you just want one poem you can, you know, get your head around and then just get on with what you're doing, you can get a lot from just one page. I find there's a lot of depth, a lot of intensity. And a poetry collection I adore is called Akhenaten, and it is poetry collection by Dorothy Porter.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very mischievous, I would say, sort of book. Not what you expect poetry to be about somehow, and I don't know why, but it's...
Yes, there is a discord between what the book contains and the name. Mm. So the name of the collection, Akhenaten, refers to an Egyptian pharaoh of the 18th dynasty, who was the ruler of Egypt between, I guess, 1350 before Christ.
The husband of Nefertiti, which we know a lot about, and he was sort of banished and hidden. And
he was, because he wanted Egypt to adore or focus on adoring the Sun King. So mm-hmm. he wanted Egypt to be a monotheistic country, basically, or a country of monotheistic religious tradition. So he managed that for 17 years, but then, of course, they wanted to go back to what there was before, so they banished any memory of him. So you would expect that this book would be about, you know, would have a lot of intertextual references and would be too heavy, mm-hmm. but then when you open it, you find a biography in verse of a beautiful person mm-hmm. who likes to watch his cats napping, who likes to line up his fences on his desk before he starts writing, who talks about the first time he tasted wine, the first time him and Nefertiti made love. Mm. So it's a very intense book in terms of physicality. And I love it particularly because of its rhythm. It has a... Dorothy Porter knows her poetic rhythm very well. It's also written in very accessible language.
Exactly, it's not...
It's funny. It's
intimidating not, at
yeah,
all.
So if you wanted to study it... to look up references and to revel in them, you can. But if you just want to read it for mm-hmm. fun and just enjoy the story of this wonderful personality in history, you can do that as well. And if you're just after a poem that shakes you in terms of its rhythmic structure, then you've got that there as well.
Yeah.
So she's a fascinating poet. I love her love poems as well. And she wrote a small essay called On Passion, which is also very... She's a very carnal writer. She likes her body and her physical presence to be embedded in her words. And
it's almost such a shame that, you know, the 50 Shades of Grey gets all of this publicity and press and something written so beautifully with such grace. And you think how it's not simple at all, but it seems, because it's so short, you know, the verses, how is it so beautiful with so few words, in a sense?
Yes.
But, it's so annoying that the wrong types of titles get the most
true. I like that you mentioned 50 Shades of Grey, because she is a very sexy writer. In Akhenaten, there is one poet called Nefertiti Rides Me, for example, which is, the title might come across as vulgar, but embedded in such grace, because it is a very graceful poetry collection, to use your choice of words there. Yes, it just transforms all sorts of everyday pleasures into very
makes you steal the lines and use them in your own life, you know, just
completely
like...
very inspiring author.
So that's so reading in verse. That's a really nice, I think, a really nice way to read, but you have to be on your own, no one around you.
No, not necessarily. No? I love reading poems to my friends. It's terrible, but there are some who have patience, and I think it is something you can, not perhaps in a group, but although I have done that, well, perhaps in a group of 4 to 5 people. Mm-hmm. But I love reading poetry to the people I spend with.
I'm such a private reader. I really don't like people around me at the best of times, let alone if I'm reading. It's literally if somebody else is in the house, I feel like they're invading.
They're invading, yeah.
You know, I have a space in my house where I can go and read, but I still, if I can hear anything else that isn't a bird outside, I really lose track, and I'm, you know, my mind is half clenched on the other thing. So yeah,
no, I understand. I guess it depends on the genre, but poems are lovely to read out loud. I love listening to audiobooks as well, and to poetry podcasts. I love observing the way people interpret. A poem can change across readership too, across readers, in terms of how they read it out loud. So
that's exactly even the person's voice can make such a difference to your like and dislike
to
and
your experience of the poem, definitely.
Completely. And sometimes I see an audiobook and I see who's reading it, and it would either put me off or attract me to that book because of the person.
They're very tricky audiobooks.
It's a really hard genre, but fantastic for when I'm cooking or driving, because you feel like someone's talking to you, you're getting the story, and you can listen to it over and over again, whereas you wouldn't stay reading the same page over and over again. You get frustrated with yourself. But if you're, you know, baking and pots and pans are crashing around you, then an audiobook is fine to have a listen to another time, where you just laugh out loud to something someone said. But even on the beach, you know, to sit there or in your car with your headphones on.
Definitely, yes.
Be able to still read without being too distracted.
Completely, yeah.
Any other books you'd like to tell us about that we can digest over the next few weeks?
I was talking earlier about my love for memoirs. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned a memoir by Doris Lessing, which I highly recommend.
Okay.
So she wrote a memoir called Under My Skin.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, which talks about the first 30 years of her life. And then that was followed by another memoir, which is called Walking in the Shade, I think. But I prefer Under My Skin because it tells the story of Doris Lessing, the child, growing up on a 1,000-acre farm in southern Rhodesia, mm-hmm. so modern-day Zimbabwe. And the way in which she knows, so I'm fascinated by the amount of detail that she remembers, but also the way she depicts herself growing up as a child, who is intensely connected to the bush that is surrounding her. Mm-hmm. So in terms of sight, sound, smell, experience of the vegetation, wildlife, also in terms of how she distributed her time between observing her family's worries. And they did have worries. Her parents, Alfred and Emily, they were born in England, but after the First World War, they moved first to Iran, mm-hmm. and then to, when Doris Lessing was 6, to southern Rhodesia to make money, basically, mm-hmm. from growing maize and other crops. But this promise never came through, so they never actually became rich, and the bush was very difficult to work in terms of land. And so, you know, she watched her mother, you know, going over the same complaints. Her father, who had an amputated leg from his previous service in the First War, you know, was very traumatized. She suspected that he had, you know, post-traumatic stress from having fought the war. But so she distributed her time at home reading in this farm, which was falling apart in a bush in the middle of nowhere. But then she had the gift of free roaming in the bush. Her parents never quite worried. They gave her her gun. They showed her how to you know,
use it,
shoot,
to defend
use
herself.
It, to shoot not people, but wildlife.
And
the farm at one point was invaded by thousands of stray cats. She just shot them point blank at a very young age. So you have this again intense physicality in the book, and I'm fascinated by the play between a chronology of someone's life and breaking with that chronology in such a graceful way, and also how you manage to, so this in terms of literary value, how Doris Lessing manages to keep you there. But this is a story with no plot. It is not a thriller. It is 30 years of someone's life. So there is a way that that can become very boring, but with Doris Lessing,
it doesn't.
That comes to life.
Yeah. Did you find the first book versus the second book, did she change how she viewed herself, or did she continue to...
From my experience of reading memoir, this is very much the case, that the strongest memoirs are the memoirs about childhood.
Okay.
There is an intense working of and filtering through childhood memories, and then working through the nostalgia to turn it into something more forceful. That takes on a very powerful form in memoirs. So in Walking in the Shades, I enjoyed that, but she became, of course, someone who was very much active in the political fabric of the left in England, and there are a lot of intricacies there, and it is beautiful, but it is loaded. It is very, you know, it is...
Maybe this one for a long train journey or a...
Sorry?
For a long train journey or...
Yes, so if you're interested in... Yes, and particularly in the history of authors of the left, there is a huge representative of that. Also, life in the 50s in London, which was when she got there, was heavy.
Completely different to... South Rhodesia.
Completely different, yes.
Really completely.
I enjoyed, in Walking in the Shade, I enjoyed how she wrote about her. So the book evolves according to the houses she changed in London, and the people who kind of visited, the different people who visited her in the different houses. I enjoyed that as a structure. And she had quite an open house for both of, you know, everyone could
come and,
come and go. She would cook, she would host, she would hear of a struggling author who needed a room for a couple of months. She'd take them in. But then she would disappear for a whole week to write and focus. You would, tenants, you know, talk about hearing her pacing in her room and smelling the cigarette smoke, but she would not...
Speak
with anyone, but then she would open up again. So she went through those bouts, and those are just lovely to
imagine and
to read. And I'm sure she was also quite a difficult, you know, she's a human being, of course. She had her...
All writers are difficult. Are you a writer yourself? Just to...
Yes, I do write poetry. I haven't published anything yet. And I would like to work a little bit on my creative writing after I get over this, you know, this phase, this doctoral phase. So they tend to interfere. I mean, I keep, I'm a regular journal writer, so I keep, I keep memories there to use in some form or other later on. But yes.
So we'll be looking out for your work soon. So thank you for listening to this week's edition of Beach Books and Beyond. My guest this week was Rachel Baldacchino, and I've been, and I still am, Monique Chambers.
Thank you for joining me, Monique Chambers, on this week's Beach Books and Beyond. I'd also like to thank Samuel Attard and Carmelo Brett for helping me to produce this programme. Join us again next week for Beach Books and Beyond, here on Campus FM.